For me anyway, dropping out a lot is just too hard of a hit mentally. So I have to be able to race, even if it means humbling myself, you know, and letting that ego go, which I think really ultra running is about letting the ego go. So in a sideways kind of way, you win if you can finish at all, no matter where you're at in the pack, as a competitive person like me, you know, just to be able to stay, I don't have to prove anything.
Welcome to the Stokecast, where each week we bring you an inspiring athlete, adventurer, or entrepreneur and dig into their stories and strategies for building and trying to balance work, life, adventure, and impact. I'm Jonathan Ronzio.
And I'm Emily Holland. Thanks for joining us today.
What's happening, listeners? Welcome back to the Stokecast. It's Jonathan Ronzio. I've got Emily Holland on the line, and we've got another episode for you today.
Another episode for you. All right.
I think that's what we do here, right? We bring episodes on the podcast.
Where am I right now?
I don't really know. Who knows?
Anyways, so we have a fantastic guest for you guys today. Her name is Candace Burt. Candace is a ultra runner, a pretty badass ultra runner. She is the owner and operator and race director for Destination Trail Races, which has been going on for 8 years or so. And she is the first person and kind of known for creating non-repetitive 200 miler races. So she has the one in Washington at Tahoe, and then in Moab, which is 240 miles. So that's fun. But she is fantastic. She has her own podcast, Humans of Ultra Running. And in this conversation, we talk a bit about, you know, how races and race directors are, you know, suffering a little bit right now or having to pivot and be adaptive. Talk a little bit about that particular business side, how she organizes around creative flow and having to get more tactical things done. We talk a little bit about knowing yourself and get a little bit deep, which we all know that I love those portions of our conversations. And it's just a fantastic discussion with someone who is out and doing a lot of really creative and amazing things for the outdoor community. So please enjoy our conversation with Candace Burt.
Candace, welcome to the Stokecast. We are excited to chat with you. How are you today?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good. Adapting to the new situation that's going on in the world, both in running and my business. But, you know, I like to look at the positive side of everything. So I'll say I'm doing good.
That's awesome. Adapting is the right word, right? And I think that's, you know, fortunately us and adventurers are used to adapting on the fly and figuring it out, right?
Yes, exactly. I think that that is a key part of any adventure is being able to adapt. Otherwise, I don't think if we couldn't adapt, we wouldn't be doing the things we're doing.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. So I think maybe to set the stage a little bit, I think, you know, for a lot of folks that we talk to, like things have shifted drastically for everyone. And many people, it's just like, well, I can't get out for my training runs or my, you know, bike rides or whatever they are. But for you, it's also your entire business. So you are run trail races. And so what's going on in the trail race world right now? And how is that, or how have you pivoted with this kind of new normal, I guess?
Yeah, it's a roller coaster of emotions, certainly, being a full-time race director. So, you know, I make my living off of it, but I also do it because I love the community and I love running. And so losing sort of that piece this whole spring and not being sure what's going to happen the rest of the year has been really challenging. I think I almost feel like, you know, it's like a scene, a battlefield, and like, I'm still standing. I still have all my events August onward, but like I'm watching left and right and races are being taken out constantly. So like UTMB just canceled. And I mean, this is a huge race, you know, and it affects all of us. People start to worry about my little 200 miler, you know, in Randall, Washington. But, you know, it's a lot different for somebody like me who's putting on 200-300 person races compared to UTMB that has, you know, 2,000 people. So my race isn't in as much danger, but obviously we all are, you know, on the fence just wondering what's going to happen. So I'm working more than ever actually on the permitting and dealing with local lawmakers and just trying to push our agenda forward in a safe way. So obviously we don't want to hold an event and put people in danger, but it's also really important that, that I think that we have these races if we can. So yeah, working.
Yeah.
So I feel like everybody's working more hours lately. I think there was a study that everybody's putting in like on average, like 3 hours more per day, just because we're kind of always on, always connected. And it's harder than ever to turn off work.
Yeah, I can believe that. I think for those of us who, again, it goes back to that adapting, that are working on adapting to this, are having to work more because we're creating new avenues to bring in business and to connect with our customers in new ways. Like, you know, we're on Zoom right now, and that's something I'd never heard of until COVID-19 struck. Have had to sort of make that decision of like, okay, are we going to put a bunch of virtual races up and try to make the best of the situation and give people options? And I looked around at the other race directors who were successfully navigating this, all these cancellations, and they were creating virtual races. And I up and did it. And so it's like creating several new businesses while operating your regular one, and getting, you know, hundreds of extra emails every day. it's really hard.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about, I mean, the virtual races. Jonathan and I were just chatting earlier about, well, just in general, like, you know, what the world's going to be like after this. And we feel like there's going to be just so much more virtual capabilities and connection. And so how have those been received? How have the virtual races been received, and what's been the community's response to those?
It's been overwhelmingly positive. I don't think any of us most of us didn't really see the advantage of virtual races before all this. And now all of a sudden, with it being pretty much our only racing option, at least in the short term, it's become this great way to connect with the people around us, to support your local race director or your local business. I mean, even Spring Energy has some virtual challenges going on. You know, that's a gel company. And so I think that virtual races will continue to be popular, and this will popularize them more. But I think that they'll probably be a boom in trail running as well, once people get past their fear, the new fears that have sort of come out of, and trauma that's come out of people being afraid of being around each other. And it might take a while for people to get comfortable being out in public. Lucky for us, I mean, trail running races aren't like going to a big concert. I don't think that the risk of transmission is as high, assuming that races are safe with food, and aid stations will have to be modified a little bit. But I think this will affect trail running for the next 10 years, but I don't think in the grand scheme of things, if we can get through it safely, that it'll have a lasting negative impact.
Yeah. I gotta say, it'd be hard to think about running 200 miles with a mask.
Oh yeah, that wouldn't be necessary. I mean, we've talked, so I mean, these are conversations I've had with many different directors and my employees, and like, how are we going to do this safely? If we had to require people to wear a mask while racing, we would just cancel the event, because I think there's a point where it's just not worth it, and where runners won't want to be a part of an event that's that restrictive. Now, might you have to wear one going into an aid station? Maybe. I'm not convinced that we're going to have to, but we may have to have volunteers who are dealing with food at aid stations wearing them. I don't think that's as big of a deal as, you know, obviously racing with a mask would be horrible.
Yeah. I like just pull it up over my face when I'm running my neighborhood now, and I'm like, Oh man, I feel like I've never run before. I'm so out of breath. I'm just like, oh my God, this is terrible. Yeah, well, that's, I mean, it's going to be, I'm sure, very challenging. But I think the really cool part about the virtual events is we're seeing people really support their local businesses, like yourself, like the, you know, your local business in itself, more than I've ever seen before. And that part has been really beautiful and uplifting.
Yeah, people have, I think they're seeing the race director side of things a little more because I think what this is bringing out the human side of all businesses that are struggling right now. I think that it's important for us to be honest and open with athletes as to our policies and why we need to have the policies the way that they are so that people don't think that they're, you know, getting cheated out of money because they're not getting a refund. But I also think it's an important time to be as generous as we possibly can, because otherwise we're going to lose the trust as race directors of our participants if we don't give them some sort of equal thing to what they paid for, whether it's a full transfer to next year or something like that. So it's challenging to navigate, and businesses that race organizations that are full-time, you know, profit run businesses like mine, it's not a nonprofit. We do this full-time and we pay our bills by it, but we also put on a race that we feel like runners get more than they paid for. So, you know, a business like mine doesn't have quite as much flexibility as, say, you know, somebody who puts on a nonprofit one race a year and they have, you know, another job they go to. So we're doing the best we can to be really generous and open with, you know, about everything that's going on so that runners can trust us and know that we're just doing the best we can.
So I'd like to learn a little bit about, like, you know, the start of Destination Trail, right? And how you I guess went down the path of designing this as your career, right? Like, where, let's go back to just the passion of you loving to run really, really far, and then thinking like, now I want to actually build races that I want to run because I want to go chart new places into the mountains, right? Like, let's take it back a step to talk about the evolution to get here.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that, that I started putting them on. So I started my business in, 2012, and the first 200 miler, I organized, which is sort of what I'm known for, was 2014. So I had begun volunteering and then working for a company here in Washington called Rain Shadow Running. And it was the first year that I got into ultras. And I think a lot of us, once we start volunteering and we see the behind the scenes community and we become a part of that, it's just a really cool, it's a really cool community. And I thought it would be an interesting way to make money. I was a massage therapist at the time, so I was making most of my money doing massage, but not very much, because it's just such a hard, massage therapy is such a hard job. And you have to work long hours to make reasonable living. So, you know, I sort of saw what Rain Shadow was doing and, liked the idea of creating like a short series in Bellingham. So the first races I came out with was, Fragrance Lake 10K, 20K, like all these just random little short, we call it the Bellingham Trail Running Series. And I created a club that sort of supported the race series. And it was my way. I just moved to Bellingham, so I was like, I'll explore all these trails and I'm going to make a club. And it was sort of my way of like making friends at the time. Like, here, give me your money. No.
Always the best way to start a relationship.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we're friends, right? No, but it was a really cool way to learn the trails in the area. And I'd actually been trying to decide between creating races and putting on running tours. And I'd worked for a company, Adventure Racing, that put on running tours, and I didn't want to step on their feet by doing tours. So it was just by chance that I just decided to do races instead. And I think, you know, like a lot of us have that mentality of like, if a little is good, a lot is great. And so, you know, 200s came along eventually.
But I mean, so you yourself though were on the journey of like, you know, how long have you been a runner until you got to that point of like creating this space for other people and then creating races based on that kind of community? And how did that passion individually, I guess, develop for you?
I began running in high school in cross country and track, and because my sister was doing track and it sounded like a good way to, again, I guess it's all about community when it comes down to it, but it was a way for me to sort of make connections and make friends. I was more of the kind of kid who made friends with animals. You know, I had a dog and I had a horse, and I think it was a way for me to relate to people, a positive way. And so, yeah, I got into track cross country, and I loved my friends that I made through that. And after I graduated from high school, I was like, it's all over, you know, like the great times of running. And there were 5Ks, you know, the Jingle Bell Dash or whatever it was in Seattle, but it's so huge, you know. It was like, I didn't have that community with it. And so I was running around, I lived on Whidbey Island at the time, and I had little kids. So I had my first daughter when I was 23. So pretty young, you know, and I was just trying to find ways to get out of the house and have some time to myself when I was running. And I met some local community members, and they were doing the Orcas Island 50K, or 25K, sorry. And I looked at the race, cause I'd just done a road marathon. I was like, I could do a 50K, you know, I just did a marathon. That's only 5 miles more. But it was like up a mountain. And I remember after that race, so I did the 50K and I could not walk. Like I had to roll out of bed and I crawled to the bathroom. I think I popped some ibuprofen. I thought I was dying. It was horrible. So I signed up for more. But I'd only ever run on roads and mostly flat, you know. So doing mountains, the mountains on Orcas, the 50K there gains like 6,000-7,000 feet. So it beat me up. Yeah. But I realized like, this is what I was looking for, was this community of people who were just different. You know, it wasn't just this massive, I've always been attracted to small towns or, you know, small races and that kind of vibe. So it sort of developed then into, I think when I like something, I like it a lot. And so I got into then directing the races as I described earlier.
Yeah, I totally agree with the, I mean, I also was like very much a road runner and was like, okay, we'll do half marathons, we'll do a marathon. And then eventually, you know, somehow signed up for a trail race with Jonathan, trail marathon. And it's so different. Like in a road pack or in a road race, you feel like you're all alone. You all have your music on. No one's like talking to each other or, you know, really cheering each other on or anything like that. And in a trail setting, I mean, I literally like, there were certain times in that particular race where I kept running into the same woman over and over again. And she would say these like really profound motivational things to me. And I was like, is she actually here? Or is she like an angel? And she's just telling me these amazing things that I need to hear right at this moment. And I was so slow and like unprepared, and Jonathan crushed it. And I was like at the end of the pack. And I remember I crossed with this like pack of women that were all like kind of at the end of the race pack. And we were all like super stoked and like giggling with each other. And I just remember that being like, okay, I think I'm done with road racing now.
Yeah.
We had a very different experience, Emily.
I thought it was beautiful. I mean, it was hard, but it was really beautiful like overall.
Which race did you do as your first?
We did this random marathon, trail marathon in Stowe, Vermont.
It was like the Von Trapp trail marathon or something like that.
Yeah, it's a little race. I don't think there was more than 50 people doing the marathon. And no, it's a half marathon, a marathon.
It was awesome. But like, while Emily found this incredible community and like stoke on the trail, I ran with like the top pack for the first like 8 miles, and then they just crushed ahead, and I kind of like went back a little, but then stayed ahead of everybody else. So probably from like mile 9 through the rest of the race, I didn't see a single soul out there. I might as well have been in Antarctica.
Well, that's definitely the story, I think, a lot of times of the more competitive front. Because I've been in the back, I've been in the middle, I've been in the front. And it feels like when you are really racing that, you know, yeah, it's a different vibe for sure. I could see
I'm
it being
just
different.
Slow.
Well, that's an interesting dynamic. So I'm curious, like, you know, your perspective on that and how you go into some races, because that, you know, has been a struggle for me too. Before the trail marathons and stuff, like I did a lot of Spartan races, and a lot of people sign up for those to go in and have this big community kind of thing where like you go with your friends and it's about staying together and getting over the wall and into the mud and all that. And I just like always wanted to go as fast as I could and have this like kind of solo push myself as hard as I could experience. And then I'd like look back and be like, oh, but like I should have stayed with everybody.
Yeah, I think I do think there's, you know, we have different, there's different personalities that just prefer different ways of competing. Or for me, I try to decide how I'm going into the race, whether I'm doing it competitively or more as a training thing. So that's part of how I go about it. Or I always have the backup plan for any competitive race. I'm not just doing it to place or to have like a certain time. I'm doing it to finish and to have the experience of it all. And so if it doesn't go the way that I sort of expect, I allow myself to sit back and enjoy the ride either way, even if it's like more painful and harder. And so I've done the Hurt 100 a bunch of times. And this last year was super wet and crazy muddy. And I just had to sit back and say, my big thing was I was going to go run the Arizona Trail in the next month. So I needed to run it carefully. So I sat back, and it's really hard for me because I am very competitive. So I have to talk myself through it. But once I sat back and started enjoying the process, I was talking to other runners and cheering them on more. You have more energy, you know, and you can eat more, which is great. So you come into the aid station, and if you're not pushing as hard, you get to eat whatever you want. So I changed my clothes and my shoes, which I never do. So I think that to really be long-term in this sport, we have to be able to do that. We have to be able to shift gears and say, you know what, today's not my day. And just go anyway, and just go slower, because the more, for me anyway, dropping out a lot is just too hard of a hit mentally. So I have to be able to race, even if it means humbling myself, you know, and letting that ego go, which I think really ultra running is about letting the ego go. So in a sideways kind of way, you win if you can finish at all, no matter where you're at in the pack. As a competitive person like me, you know, just to be able to say, I don't have to prove anything.
Mm. Just gonna let that linger for a second. I feel like a lot of people do struggle with that, though, you know. And Jonathan and I are very different in our approaches. I'm very much like, I just want to finish. I don't care. And then I'll like surprise myself with the, with the result. I'm like, oh, cool. I did better than I thought. And Jonathan's like, well, also just Jonathan, you're a better athlete than I am. And I'm like very clumsy and like lopping along. But I think that's really hard for people. And I mean, what is it about the longer races and the longer distances, even if they're not races and they're just like objectives? What do you think it is that like really keeps you coming back to that? Maybe it is the ego thing, maybe it's something else, but what is the thing that like drives you towards those objectives?
adventure. I'm in it for the stories. And I think that the longer you're out there, the more interesting things get. Patience comes into play. So really with the long races, if you're too impatient or you play that knife edge too much as a competitor, you get so hard on yourself. If it's not going well for 5 miles, it really doesn't matter, right? In the scheme of a 100-mile race. Oh, so you had a bad 5 mile, 10 mile, even 20 mile section. That may have no bearing on the rest of the race, but a lot of people let it create like a mental state, a deteriorating mental state. And so the more you let those little things bother you, the less likely you are to succeed, because really like a lot can go wrong and you could still win, or you could still place on the podium, or you could get your finish. And every finish I've ever gotten, no matter where I finished in the pack, has been way better than any DNF, because I get that full experience. Like I get to the tunnel and I crawl through it and I like come out the other side, rather than getting to the tunnel and being like, no, I can't do this. You know, it's way more satisfying. So I think for me, that adventure and then just pushing through whatever challenge comes up, it's always something you don't expect. Is pretty cool experience.
Have you seen Vanilla Sky, the movie?
No, I don't think so.
Good flick. Movie, I mean, some people may argue with that. I think it's like a polarizing film as far as who like is obsessed with it and who thinks it's like the worst trash ever made. but I love it. It's an old film with Tom Cruise, and there's a line from Penelope Cruz in that movie where she says every passing minute is another chance to turn it all around. Right. And that's always resonated with me. And I think like what you were just talking about, as far as like not beating yourself up over what happened the last 5 to 10 miles, or not beating yourself up over like the comment on that last post, or the thing that went wrong on that last pitch with your business or whatever. Right. And just understanding that like, now is a new moment, and it's like you can reframe that perspective and turn it around.
Yeah, and that reminds me, like, it's all about accepting the moment you're in and adjusting to it. I think a lot of times in a race we go, no, I'm okay. Like you have this thought, right? I should eat. And then you think, well, you know, I got to get something out of my pack, or blah, blah, blah. You talk yourself out of what your body is asking you to do. Or you're running with somebody and you're like, oh, I feel like I'm going too fast. And your brain goes, no, you should be able to go this fast. If you want to get this time, you need to go this fast. And so rather than talking yourself out of the position you're truly in at that moment, I think it's really important to accept it and make those adjustments. And we're talking about any ultra. If you listen to your body, you're going to do so much better than if you try to pretend like you're not where you're at. And a lot of people go into races thinking, well, maybe I'm well trained. Well, if you're well trained, you're going to know, you know, like go into it with a realistic expectation based on what you've really put in. And so I think in racing, and really in the time of COVID right now, it's important too. Like we have to accept this is where we're at. You know, there's cancellations happening. Okay, where are we going to go? How are we going to adjust from here? And then you put the power back in yourself. Because anytime that you're trying to fool yourself into believing your situation is different than it is, you have no power to adjust.
Man, just hit me with the truth bombs here.
It's funny.
Yeah, I learn a lot.
When like there are certain things now, like, you know, 80 whatever or 90 something episodes into this show, that like I just know are gonna hit Emily right in the heart. And like, and as soon as they're said, I just know, like, I don't have to chime in, because Emily's just gonna sit there and go, wow. And like let it resonate, and you're hitting some of these hits here.
Call me out, Jonathan.
I'm calling you out. No, in a good way. In a good way.
So I'd love to hear, Candace. You know, you mentioned, I think you mentioned one daughter, but you have two girls, right?
Yeah.
I'd love to hear how you incorporate and bring them into the fold, whether it's at the races or that you're running, or just for your love of running in general? Is that something that they're grasping on to, and how does that work?
People ask me a lot, you know, are they runners? Like, of course they are, right? And I'm like, they are, but they don't know it yet. they're 12 and 15, two girls. And so just hitting that teenager stride. And I guess as a parent, I put a lot of controls about what they are passionate about in their own hands. So I've never really been one to push anything. Although they might say I try to push them to go on hikes, but other than that.
That's just good for you, plain good for you, yeah.
It is. See, right, exactly. So, yeah, so they're really into art and jumping on the trampoline and their friends and reading. And then they'll come out to a lot of the events that I put on, actually all but two that happen during the school year that they can't make, but they come out to the Bigfoot 200, you know, for the couple weeks that we're out there, and, you know, we camp out in the RV and put on this race. They sleep all weird hours of the day and night because I'm not so good about telling them when to go to bed when we're up like 24/7, but, you know, they'll go to bed by like midnight and sleep in or something. But yeah, it's a funny schedule. And so they'll be out, like, it's so cute to see them out trying to sling merchandise, you know, and you can't argue a price. Yeah, and like, they're not going to argue a price with a kid, you know. It's like, it's pretty cool.
That's the tactic. That's the tactic, yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
What an incredible experience for them.
It. Yeah, yeah, and I hope so. I mean, it's funny because they're like, you know, a marathon is not very impressive. You know, we have our friends tell us about, you know, so-and-so's run a marathon, and we're like, yeah, uh-huh, so. So it's like, they're just not, I think that to them, the running like this is just so normal, that it'll be interesting to see sort of where that goes. Like, they'll do their exercise videos and stuff during the day, or like, I'll see my daughter using my weights or something. So it'll be cute to see sort of where it goes, especially with no pressure on my end. I'm like, you know, take it or leave it, like, you go on a run with me. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see what passions they grasp, and it could be anything, you know, that they're into. Hopefully, if they get anything from it, it's like, put your all into something, and it's amazing sort of what can develop out of it.
I'm sure. Like, I mean, and even more than just like, who knows if they do get into running or not, but like, the experience of hucking those t-shirts, right? And being around race logistics and seeing the motivation and determination and drive you have to, like, to train for something that big, or to, you know, to plan the race, or to pivot to the virtual race, like, all of that is that it's invaluable learning experience for them that can be applied to so many different aspects of their life when they grow up and find their thing.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's really important for them to get to see all the different aspects like that. And for me, being that, you know, as a single parent, they see all sides. Like, there's no way to hide really anything that happens in terms of business or emotionally. Like, you just sort of, you know, they just sort of see that whole process, or how, you know, with COVID, I had to adjust and suddenly start working on a whole bunch of new ways of bringing in business. And so, yeah, I hope that they can use those tools for the many challenges I'm sure they'll face in their lifetime as well, for sure.
Now, how has, like, family time been for you lately? Because, you know, of course we hear, with everybody now working remote, or at least if they can, right, across the world, and everybody being forced to just fuse work life now together, and you know, kids not being in school, that presents a lot of challenges. I'm curious how you've been able to to handle that, like still, you know, putting in more hours than you were for the business and also having a family at home?
Yeah, their school was canceled in mid-March, and then they canceled it for the rest of the year in April. So I guess in a way I'm lucky because they're teenagers, and even though they still need a lot of guidance and time, they're able to structure their day. And it's amazing to see them adapting because basically all teachers and students now had to learn how to do all the schoolwork online. At least with their school, they started online work immediately. And I was like, uh-oh. You know, first off, I was telling you earlier, we have weak Wi-Fi where I live. And so I was like, this is going to be interesting, all of us on the computers during the day. But they've just adapted where we've sort of created a schedule. And so my way of dealing with it was to write down, like, you know, you've got your schoolwork. That's really important. That has to be done each day. But I also want to make sure that you get out and get some sort of exercise each day. So we had the exercise, the schoolwork, and the chores. And then we just break up other chores where, you know, Marina feeds the dogs in the morning, Stella feeds them at night. And then whoever makes dinner doesn't have to do the dishes. So we just created a routine around it. And I think like anything, it was awkward at first and we're still bumping into things and, you know, there's still a sink full of dishes. And so we're making the best of it, but it's definitely added a whole another level of challenging. And so I'll go on a run and, you know, tell them to give me a call if there's any issues, but luckily they're at an age where I can be on a run for a few hours and, you know, they can do whatever, jump on the trampoline or read a book and not have to be entertained. I'm sure it would be much harder, a much different situation for parents who have like 5, 6, 7, 8 year olds. That for sure. I feel for people who, you know, are dealing with toddlers and younger kids.
Yeah. It's, I mean, Jonathan and I both don't have children, and I just can't imagine. So my heart goes out to everyone listening that has little kids or just kids in general right now. And I know it's challenging, but we're kind of in a new norm. So hopefully things are kind of leveling off again. Well, kind of going back to creating your own company in 2012, I'd love to hear your process in, you know, deciding to and when to bring on, you know, help. So you say you have employees, whether that's, you know, I'm sure you have volunteers for the races as well. So like expanding the team and what that process was like for you in building that out.
Yeah, it's become increasingly important to have the right people in the right positions so that business is sort of smooth and seamless. But we still operate from, you know, just a few employees and a lot of volunteers on site for races and then a lot of independent contractors who just work for specific events. We still just don't have quite enough work for more than a couple people full time all year. So but we have a ton of work associated with each event. So it's sort of like trying to cram pack all this work into, you know, a few months. We go, oh man, it's so stressful. Like the 200 mile season from June, and the first 200 miler is in early August. So we put on 3 in a row, August, September, October. There's all these ordering and, there's lots of last minute smaller permits and constant work with the entrants, making sure that they actually have to navigate with GPX. So we have to make sure everybody understands how to use that kind of stuff. And anyway, it's so we do have a lot more individuals who come in to help for those 3 months. I have a whole team of people who come in. We have professional photographers who get paid to be on site, and then course marking, our course marking team, headquarters captain. So right now, though, it's just me and Crystal. Unfortunately, we had to let another full-time employee go who had been hired recently because of the coronavirus. We just couldn't pay another salary, unfortunately, at this time. We were just in the midst of expanding a little bit more and taking on a new race director, but it suddenly didn't make sense to grow on a year where, you know, we're going to be hit, I think, pretty hard.
Yeah. And so when did you start to think about, and maybe this was always the goal, I'm not sure, but when did you start to think about putting out, you know, the podcast Humans of Ultra Running and starting to get more, you know, people involved in that and, you know, interviewing folks and putting that out into the world?
I think when podcasts started getting popular, I feel like that was probably early, probably around when I created the Tahoe 200, 2014, 2015. I had been thinking about it for a while. I used to be on Trail Runner Nation podcast quite a bit. They'd have me as a guest or co-host, which is probably too generous of a term, but I had fun with that. And so I'd always thought like, oh, it'd be fun to do one, but you know, in the back of your mind, it's probably a lot more work than it sounds like. And, the starting it thing took me a while, but, I think finally it just, it hit me, I guess now a year and a half ago, right after the Moab 240 was over, our season of races. And I'd been thinking about hiring like a video crew to do videos for like a video channel and add that on to what we were doing. So I've sort of always been playing with, I probably always have 100 ideas going. And the hardest thing for me is picking one and you know, sticking with it, because it's almost like I definitely have far too many to do. So I finally just started the podcast and taught myself as well as I could. I wanted to do every aspect of it so that I understood it. So yeah, I started it and I started having a lot of fun, but it's definitely like doing a podcast is nerve wracking. I think it still is for me sometimes, nowhere near the same level, but you know, I want to be prepared and I want to know something about the people I'm talking to. What if I forget their names, you know, like stupid stuff like that. But yeah, you know the drill. It's a lot of work. And then just booking guests is like a full-time job.
Oh yeah. Oh my gosh. We can take that offline.
Yeah.
It's challenging. Yeah.
It is. Yeah.
No, that's so true though. Like I think you hit obviously Emily with the booking guest thing. For the Stokecast, Emily handles a lot of the coordination and the booking of guests, and I'm more on the creative and production side. But with you know, having 100 ideas all the time and trying to pick like what to pursue, I know that's one of my biggest problems, and I think that's like anybody who's creative that might be listening is probably feeling the same thing. And it's like what to do when. And
yeah,
like how to bring something to life and why this thing versus the other thing. And I think that cripples a lot of people to figure out, like, you know, they might not even start on one because they feel like they're neglecting five others and then they don't start at all instead of just trying three. Right.
Yes. And how many, windows do you keep open on your computer? I'm curious. Are you one of those people that can keep just a couple, or do you have like 20 going? What's your
like different applications or like tabs?
Tabs.
All right. So I'll get like literally right now. I've got
live reading. Yeah.
So I've got one Chrome window open that has six tabs, and it's all related to Stokecast and your channels and things that we're talking about. And then I've got another that is
Say that's not that bad, but
no, that's not
okay,
that bad.
Keep going.
So I separate them with new windows, right? So on Chrome I just hit that command N, and so right, I've got one window with six tabs. That's Stokecast stuff right now. I've got another window with 12 tabs is the Trainual tab, which is my tech company. And then I've got an idea window that has 3 tabs right now with like different notes and things that I'm putting on the back burner, but just still keeping open.
Yeah. So, I mean, I feel like that's like the creator, right? It's, and you can almost have, if you're not careful, all these things that you have as ideas can just stop you in your tracks. And sometimes I'll be like, well, I'll look at Facebook because I can't, you know, there is too much other stuff to do. And then you get caught on that for an hour. And then before you know it, like half the day has gone by and you haven't started on any of these projects because it's like the monkey brain is just like, no, I want to play. Like, I don't want to focus. But yeah, at least I like your organizational technique with the tabs. I might have to utilize that.
It helps me compartmentalize like what window I'm in when, right? Like all day I was in different webinars and team meetings and stuff. And then like prior to this call, minimize that. That one's off the screen. And now the one I'm looking at is the 6 tabs related to this conversation and this project. And that helps. But I'm for sure, it's very hard for me to tame that monkey brain.
Yeah. I don't understand people who are able to keep things more organized, but I do think I'm very good at multitasking, and that's one of the keys to my success. But it's also when things don't go well, it's because I'm multitasking. So it's sort of like it's also my Achilles heel. My superpower is my Achilles heel.
Gifts and curses, right?
Yeah.
So how, let's like double click on this for your projects, right? Like how do you think about, you know, working on the podcast versus working on the races versus like the brand relationships with your sponsors and your personal content on Instagram versus training for your own objectives versus your family? Like what's the mental organization look like for you with all of that?
Chaotic. I think that the balancing game is really just the scales tipping hard one way or another any given time. It's rare that things feel really balanced. I'm still trying to find that like perfect structure, because there's a huge part of me that hates structure. Like I don't want appointments. I work for myself, so I don't have to schedule things, but then it's like, you can't get anything accomplished. I can't get anything accomplished in work or in a podcast or anything unless I have these set meetings and schedules. And so I think that, I decide what's important to me. And I prioritize those things. So it, kids would probably be the first, kids, dogs, their immediate needs are going to be taken care of. And then I think that, there's the running is up there, but if there was a business thing that was pressing, business would always be more important than, my competitive running training, even though that's a really close second to work. So I play it on that end, and any deadline that's coming up, I'm definitely more on the end of a procrastinator. I'm really good under pressure. So, I work well close to deadlines, but if I have too much time to do something, I'll just wait and do it later. Unless it applies to like important work stuff. So I'm getting permits done way in advance, you know? So there are, I guess I found a balance, but it does feel pretty chaotic. I think any business person, well, maybe not any, maybe there's some people out there that are really organized and have all their stuff together. I don't know. It doesn't feel like that.
I often think about like time blocking as, Let's take about, you know, like a backpack, right? So just a normal, right, you know, backpack for trail is just going to be like generally one big open compartment, right? Or maybe it's like your 60 liter pack for backpacking thing. It's just a big backpack. It's open in the middle. And then like you will fill whatever space you have with things that you might not need, but you'll just keep packing it in because you have the space. And there's not any real intentionality to it because it's just a big open container. And that might be like the week without time blocks, right? But then like, yeah. if you get a bag for your photo gear, like let's say you're a photographer and you buy one of those bags that has like the pre-compartmentalized, like this is where the camera goes, this is where your memory cards go, this is where this lens and this GoPros goes, then you're going to pack what there's space for and that's it.
Yeah. I think that's a really great way of putting it, because I have found that if I don't create structure within the week or days or months, that I can just sort of float along, jumping from one thing to another. And so I find the weeks that I have certain scheduled meetings being more effective, because then I just schedule things around them. And right now I'm playing with the idea of like, okay, I'll pick this certain day, that's just podcast day, and then these 3 days will be full on work, and then I can do my long runs on these other. And I think that we also have to have those boundaries for work, those of us who are self-employed, because otherwise, like, I'm the type where I'll be working at like midnight, 1 a.m. on a roll, you know, but then the next morning you can't get up early. And so it negatively affects you if you don't have sort of boundaries within your work environment too. So I'm finding that balance, and you'd think I would have it by now, but when I get inspiration, I also know though that you have to go with it. Like there's times where you get an idea and you need to play that out because there's a lot of energy behind it. So there are times where I think the rules don't apply. And creativity is one of those things where when it strikes, like go for it, or, you know, you'll give it up, you'll lose it.
Oh yeah. Lightning in a bottle. It's like, it doesn't matter if it's 1 a.m. Like if I wake up from a dream and like had a spark of an idea, I'm going to get on my computer and be tinkering away at something.
Yeah, it's important to seize that moment and go for it. I learned that with writing, because I love writing. But, you know, if you just try to sit down in front of a computer, at least I haven't taught myself to do it so well this way, and just try to write, it's like doesn't quite work as well. But I feel like I tap into this like stream of something every once in a while, and I'm like, ooh, that's how I can describe that feeling. And once I start writing, then I'm able to organize the thoughts. And so it's almost like that's how I tap into the creativity. And I have to utilize it while it's like there. I've sort of recognized that feeling of creativity. And if I feel that certain energy behind it, I know that it's going to resonate with other people. And that goes like races that I've created that have turned out to be really successful. Like I knew they were going to be, I just knew it in my bones, you know, like deeply. And it might've taken a while for them to develop, but because they had that same energy behind them, they just take off in a way that like you can create a race. If you just create a race, well, I'd like to make this much money and there's a trail in this place, but it has no energy behind it. It just fizzles out. Like I've seen the difference. I've created both types of races, and I've learned sort of what to put my energy toward. I still make mistakes, but mostly I think I've picked up a little bit on what's going to be a big hit and what won't be.
Yeah. I think the big takeaway from that like last 5 minutes for both of you is that blocking your calendar is really helpful, but also to follow the creative energy, because I feel like that's really hard for people. I mean, especially a lot of times with writers, any sort of creatives really, I guess, is, you know, you'll say, well, I'm going to write for 2 hours every morning. I'm going to write from 7 to 9 every single morning. And it's like, sometimes even myself, I'll sit down to do that, and I'm like, I don't have anything to say right now, and this is not a good like use of my time. And so everyone out there, follow the creativity when it's happening to you, because you can feel it, right? It's kind of like, ooh, it feels really nice. It's like a higher vibration.
It's a flow. It's that like whatever it is in our bodies that's creating that feeling, it's definitely worth going with. I'll feel that on, I also find like if I go on a run, I don't know if it's like the increased blood flow or just the movement, but it's like you can get all these ideas. But now some of these ideas, I don't know if you guys have had this. So you get this like great idea on a run and you're like, oh, I'm totally going to do this when I get home. And then you get home, you're like, that wasn't a great idea. Like, or that's like way too much work. I'll have those ideas.
Yep. Yeah. Running is the best idea, like creator for sure.
It is.
Outdoor movement. That's the idea machine.
Yeah,
it is. Yeah. It'll get things going.
So I almost feel bad sometimes because I'll stop in the middle of a run and like pull out my phone and put it in my notes. And I'm like, okay, that's how I want to say that one thing that I've been trying to think about.
Yeah. Right. Cause it's like, you feel like you should be doing your workout, and I'll get ideas and be writing them down. And I think though it's worth stopping it if you think of something, because sometimes that's when the channels open up, and otherwise you'll forget. There's too many things going on in our brains nowadays.
Yeah.
Preach. Well, for people that potentially like don't necessarily know the feeling of flow or know that like, you know, that creative energy when it strikes, like I think there's a lot of people that are still trying to figure out how to find that and then how to channel it and put it into action. Like, do you have any tips?
Yeah,
I think
it's a hard one because I guess I've always used emotion to drive creativity. And so when I feel something really strongly, that usually is a way for me to tell sort of where to go with it. So I guess the advice that I could give, since we can only go from our own experiences, you can usually get a good feeling for something based on how it makes you feel in your body. And there's some things that make us feel really gross or uncomfortable or nervous in a bad way. And that's, I think, a sign that there's something there. It might not mean we shouldn't do it. Maybe it means that we should push through that fear. But like, let's say you want to buy a house or something and you're getting this feeling like it's not right. You know, it's important to realize that I think our brains try to talk ourselves out of our reality that we're in or something that we're seeing. You know, we try to talk ourselves out of it. It happens in relationships all the time, right? You'll think in your head, oh, this isn't right for me. And I know it. And then you'll go, but they're so nice. And you know, this person's very good looking, or you'll sort of talk yourself into this. You have this feeling and you know it. And then you just go, you know, you just do what society does to you, right? You convince yourself otherwise, because if you accept that reality, this person isn't right for me, then you have to do something about it. And sometimes we aren't ready to. But if we are, then one of the most powerful things we can do is listen to our bodies in that way. And I think that once you start opening yourself up to listening to your body in your relationships, in your work, maybe it's quitting a job, maybe it's starting another job, maybe it's starting training for a race, it could really be lots of different things, then I think inspiration will come. Sometimes we're living a life where it's hard to be inspired because we're not working the job we want, because we've convinced ourselves. Again, we've talked ourselves out of the reality that we actually want. Well, I need to make money. I have kids to feed. Well, my wife wouldn't want it. My husband doesn't think I'd be good at that. You know, like all these thoughts. So it's important to go back to sort of what we actually know in ourselves. And it's funny because it's like we've all grown up in a way where we've been convinced that to teach ourselves to talk through what we really know, talk ourselves out of what we really know. So I've been trying to relearn what I think that we all probably naturally would do as humans, but we've become so part of society that, you know, we take other people's opinion into account before our own. And And our parents will often teach us, like, no, that's not right for you. Like, do it this way. So that's how I would access creativity, is going back to those deeper feelings and needs that your body's already telling you.
Yeah, it's amazing the amount of science that actually show the, you know, that like gut feeling, that terminology is actually because your stomach is like connected to your brain and it's reacting into a way that is like helping you to try to push through something, you know?
Wow. Yeah.
There's really cool stuff there. I just wrote a book by Glennon Doyle that she talks about this idea, she calls it the knowing, which is kind of what you're talking about. It's really the idea that of knowing what you yourself really want, not what your husband or your wife or your parents or someone else is telling you that you should want, but like you actually wanting. And she goes through this entire process where she lost the idea of that. And she goes through like a year where she'll just spend 10 minutes in like a dark closet every morning, just listening to herself. And I don't know that that's necessarily the thing that everyone needs to do, but it just reminded me of that. And that we could probably all use a little bit, we could all benefit from getting a little bit closer to our own knowing.
Yeah, totally. I think it's a powerful thing to sort of take the power of our own lives, you know, and sort of crafting them in the way that we want, into our own hands again, because I do think that generally, if we do what's right for us, it's going to be right for other people too. And I don't mean that in, I mean, there's a lot of ways you could read that the wrong way. But I think generally what's good for me is going to be good for my family too. Going on a run is going to level out, you know, emotionally and make me stronger physically. That's good for my kids because I'm a better parent. So I think ultimately people are sometimes afraid of being selfish, when really that I think being selfish is an important part of taking care of our families too, and being selfish in a healthy way. I mean, not going out and having an all night bender, you know, or something like that. But
but an all night 200 miler, that's acceptable for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I have my limits, but yeah, I know it's funny because I am in what would be considered an extreme sport, but much like how my kids feel about extreme running, it's like it's quite normal to me. There are ways to do it healthier and unhealthier, but yeah, it's definitely pretty extreme for most people.
I think you're right though, that like you have to be selfish to a degree. Like being selfish is actually an act of selflessness, because often like by doing the thing that's right for you, it allows you to do more things that are right for everybody else. Right. Like you can't serve people. If you are unhappy, if you are not fulfilled, then you're not going to be motivated to do more for others. So I think you have to scratch that itch for yourself and not second guess your gut and follow the intuition and do the thing that is ultimately right for you and going to make you happy, so that then you can do more for the rest.
I had a mother who really took care of everybody else, you know, and seeing her do that and seeing how it could create resentment too, though, because she gave too much of herself. I think that, yeah, I think it's totally one of those things where you have to realize that just because you think that giving somebody else these things is what they want, it doesn't mean it is what they want. You're being sort of selfish in thinking that's in doing stuff for people that they haven't asked for, or there's just sort of, that's almost controlling in its own way. You know what I mean? So it's like, I think that what I want my children and my family to be able to do is see, like, okay, you know, Candace does what she needs to do to take care of herself, to build her business. But she also, you know, makes us dinner every night and, you know, we all eat together. And so I do think there's a balance, but I think that people have to be a little careful when they think they're doing things out of service. Well, are you really doing it because somebody really needs and wants it? Or are you doing it and then you're going to be resentful because they didn't ask for it and then they aren't appreciative? So it's a hard one.
Right. You're doing it maybe in an effort because you derive your own self-worth out of feeling like you can help somebody else that may not ask for it, but it's giving you a distraction because you don't want to help yourself.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. It's playing with all those like relationship boundaries, you know, of healthy kind of stuff that I think that when we're in our teens and 20s, we don't understand those concepts as well. We start to learn like, you know, how important it is to be there for ourselves as much as it is for other people.
100%. Well, I'm going to take this out of the depths of our souls for a second. And because that got really, really meaty and that was great. But so we're nearing the end of our time chatting here. And before we get to our final question, there is one question that I do want to ask. How do you approach training for a 200-mile race? Because like when you were talking a little bit about like your 50-miler or the 50K or whatever, like I felt very similar, like where Emily and I did that marathon. And then after that, we both signed up for a 50K and I went and did it and like couldn't walk for like a day. And I felt like I was trained enough. And then like thinking about now going to do 100 or 200 feels like, how the heck am I going to get through that without tearing my IT band and being paralyzed for 3 months? And I'm just curious how you approach that.
Yeah, that's a big question because I mean, there's definitely no miracle quick training technique to be ready for the really long stuff without having, I think, a solid background in ultra running. The trade-off that people make when they jump into the long stuff right away is that, just like you said, they're going to deal with definitely a higher incident of injury, slower finish times. They're probably going to hit a wall because they're not going to start slow enough, but they're just going to get to this point where they're going to, the training load of the race is just too high for the background they have in running. I think that I was able to get into, let's say 200. So I ran my first 200 miler competitively last spring, 2019. So a year and some months ago. And, I mean, I've been racing hundreds for years now. And so going to the 200 mile level was actually pretty easy for me, a pretty easy leap. And I'd also seen so many runners do my 200s and sort of things that had worked for them and not. And so, I came out of that race feeling great. But I did start training, again, too quickly after that and got injured. So there's this fine line you have to play right after too, where you should take more rest time than you think. That's one thing I learned from it. But I would just say that generally, I think once you as an athlete get through that period of time where you're dealing with all the little niggles that you get, the Achilles pain, like you said, the IT band pain, I think it's actually an important part of our running journey. If we're going to be lifelong runners, let's say that we sort of go through some of those injuries and inflammations and tendonitises, and we learn how to treat and deal with them. Because one thing we learn as we get older is that some things just stick around and we have to deal with them year after year after year. But we can, and that's a great thing with running. We have human bodies and they need upkeep. And so there's just certain things that I've learned that I have to do on a regular basis. I do the Alfredson protocol for my Achilles because I'll get Achilles pain if I don't. And it's easy, you know, you just have to do these heel lowers on both feet every so often. And so I love weightlifting too. So I've added that in. And I find that weightlifting a couple times a week at least, and then biking one day. I'll do a long bike ride on Fridays, and I take Mondays off, and then I run all the rest of the days of the week. That is a really great way for me to be able to train year round and rarely get injured. But I've also been running now since I was probably like over 20 years. So I'm 38. And so I've been running since I was, you know, a teenager. So I have a good base, you might say.
Yeah. That helps.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think though, at some point you have to jump into it too. Like, you know, I'm not saying wait 20 years to do a 200 at all. I've seen people go from half marathon to 200, but I think it's important to, if you're inspired by a race, sign up for it, you know, and start training. And then worst case scenario, you're going to have to drop out, but you'll still have this great experience that you're going to get to learn from. And runners should not be afraid of the DNF. I mean, I think that we should try to get through it if we can, but it's not worth destroying our bodies or letting it affect us too much mentally.
Yeah. Well, good. All good tips, and people can kind of take that and hopefully mold it into their own kind of path to, you know, winning the Tahoe 200.
Yeah, exactly.
Nice. Just winning it by finishing it. There it is. Well, Candace, we ask everyone the same question at the end of our interviews, and that is, what does Stoke mean to you?
I would say, along the lines of what we talked about, it's that flow state that we get when we're doing something that we love or loving something that we're doing.
Yeah. Simple. I love it. I feel like I'm going to have some good creative stoke this weekend. I just have a good feeling about it. There's like, you know, the sun is shining and I'm stoked to get into creative flow.
Nice. I'm just ready for my first like long run in a bit. I kind of like metered back to deal with some inflammation and hadn't been running a ton. And I'm hoping to get out and get maybe 18 or 20 in the trails this weekend.
Cool. Nice. Yeah. I got a 20 miler on Saturday, so I got to figure out where I'm going to run. Are you guys able to get out on the trails? Where are you located?
I'm in Boulder, and so I'll be going somewhere on trails trying to avoid the crowds.
Yeah. That's a hard thing. It's a little stressful right now for sure.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And I am a little bit south of Boston, and actually just right across the street from a big trail reservation. There's like, I don't know, like 6,000 acres of trails and mountain biking and all that right across from my house. So it's a pretty nice situation right here.
Oh, cool. Yeah. It's nice to be close to the trails. It definitely helps motivate to not have to go too far.
Definitely. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure picking your brain about ultra running, about, you know, your business and everything going on in your world right now. So thank you so much for joining us here on Stokecast.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And actually, where would you like our listeners to connect with you? I know you've got so many different projects and things going on, but where's like the best spot to just dive into your world and connect?
Probably the simplest thing, they can go to CandaceBurt.com is where I put a lot of my writing, but it probably has links to everything else. So like I say, probably, I should probably know. It definitely has links to my races and social media and stuff. So they could just go there and, you know, get a taste for my crazy world.
All right. Amazing. Well, Candace, thank you again. This has been a blast.
Really hope you enjoyed that episode. Before you go, it would mean the world to us if you dropped a review of the podcast wherever you're listening. And also, if you're not subscribed yet, definitely hit that button so you can tune in each week and not miss an episode. But also, don't miss out on the conversations happening inside our member Facebook group. Just search The Stokecast Podcast on Facebook and join up. Or reach out to say hi on socials at eHalls, at Jonathan Ronzio, or at The Stokecast. Thanks again, and stay stoked.